The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Hello, and welcome to the American College of Osteopathic Internists Annual Convention and Scientific Sessions. This year's meeting was held in conjunction with the Annual Clinical Assembly of the American College of Osteopathic Surgeons. The meeting was held October 11th through 15th, 2017, and featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of interest to the practicing physician. The meeting was held at the Gaylord National Resort and Convention Center in National Harbor, Maryland. The program chair is Dr. Annette Karen, and the theme for this year's presentations is Goldilocks Medicine, Not Too Little, Not Too Much. Determining appropriate surgery for esophageal cancer is presented by Dr. Peter Bake.
So the learning objectives, one is the identifying the esophageal cancer patients who are candidates for surgical resection, and what are the preoperative optimization based on NCC and SDS guidelines. And compare, I guess I'm vertically challenged. And contrast the surgical and oncologic outcomes between different types of esophageal cancers. Man, I can see over the podium. And discussing the surgical decisions making regarding resection following neoadjuvant therapy or salvage esophagectomy, or describing the surgical tips that can be employed while operating in a radiated field. So, I don't have anything to disclose, unfortunately. And I think one of the most important things that we have to know, especially for the internists, is the CWER classification. All the guidelines are based on the CWER classifications. And the ones that we're interested in when it comes to esophageal cancer or esophagectomies is the CWER 1 and 2. Those are the from 2 centimeters from the anatomic easy junction below, 2 to 5 centimeters above the EG junction. When it's type 3, which is 2 to 5 centimeters below EG junction, we consider that as a gastric cancer. And you could see that on the AJCC 8th edition, and that's how they separate it. And esophagectomies, it's a life-changing event. I spent about 30, 40 minutes talking to the patients what having an esophagectomy means. You have to be able to sleep, head of bed greater than 30 degrees, being on soft diet for a while, including liquid diet, then full liquid, then soft diet. And people don't realize how bad the soft diet is until they actually do it, and it's very difficult. And so we have the nutritionists get involved early on. Also, another things are, Americans are so used to having big meals at once and having to do small, frequent meals 6-8 times a day. That's very important. Having to drink water while eating, at least 2 hours after last meal, or before going to bed, you have to not eat anything for 2 hours so that you could empty out your esophagus. Otherwise, you're going to have really bad reflux symptoms or aspiration. And we recommend patients to walk after eating. And one of the biggest questions is, when can I eat steak? Well, I tell them that they're not going to be able to take big chunks of steak. But in about a year, most patients, they're able to chew well, but able to enjoy it. So one of the most important things about esophagectomies or any type of surgery for cancer is multidisciplinary care. I mean, I can't not... if you are doing, or you're seeing surgeon or taking care of patients with esophageal cancer, and you're not involving medical oncology, radiation oncology surgeons in a room, and sometimes arguing, sometimes it gets preheated, especially amongst the radiation oncology surgeons, but it's really important to weigh in all the options because, again, this is a life-changing event that lasts lifelong, and the morbidity is very high compared to other surgeries that I do. So according to the NCC guidelines, esophagectomies, it could be a first-line therapy for adenocarcinoma between TIS to T1B N0, or squamous cell cancer. It's a little different because if the squamous cell cancer has low risk features, like less than 2 centimeters in size, or well differentiated, then it could be considered for squamous esophagectomy. However, if you have in-situ disease, you have other options. Endoscopic mucosal resection, ablation, cryotherapy, you got PDT or photodynamic therapy, or you could do esophagectomy. But for T1As, you cannot really rely on ablation alone, so you end up doing EMR. And for superficial PT1B, also same thing as the T1A, but make sure that endomucosal resection is performed. And for T1B N0 to T4A NX M0, so non-metastatic, esophagectomy can be considered after neoadjuvant chemotherapy or chemoradiation. The multi-station lymphatic involvement, it's a relative contraindication, but a lot of times you're not going to know that even on PET scan until you actually do the esophagectomy. So I think that's why it's a relative contraindication. But if it's involving the major vessels, heart, trachea, adjacent organs, or if you have bulky lymphadenopathy, usually they're not going to do well after surgery, or non-regional nodal disease or metastatic disease. According to the Society of Thoracic Surgeons in 2014, again, they emphasize multidisciplinary management. And after neoadjuvant therapy, restaging needs to be performed, which is done by PET scan. And as you guys know, PET scan is limited by the size of the lesion. So if it's less than 4 to 6 millimeters, it's not going to show up. So it's limited, but this is what we have right now. Another thing that you can do is you could do diagnostic laparoscopy to see if there's any involvement intraperitoneally, but that's controversial as well. And then for anal carcinoma, you could do neoadjuvant chemoradiation or chemotherapy, but for squamous cell cancer, you should do neoadjuvant chemoradiation. So preoperative optimization, I think this is really important because a lot of the patients, when they become symptomatic from the esophageal cancers, you know, they're not eating as well. And so you got to make sure you look at prealbumin, albumin. And one of the things that we look at or compare is when they show up to see me and then follow up restaging CT, look at the total psoas muscle area. So that kind of tells us a couple of things. One is a nutrient status. How much muscle are they losing? But another thing is how much muscle are they using as well? And actually looking at the cross-sectional area in the same kind of region of the psoas muscle. So everyone's going to be different per se. Some people say do it at about L2 or L3 level to be consistent. But I think it's really useful when you compare pre and post neoadjuvant therapy to see how active they are, if they're maintaining their muscle volume. Nutritional support can be done by jejunostomy or using nutritional supplementation if they can eat or at least drink Ensure and Boost. That of course, drinking Ensure Boost after about a week, they get really tired of it really fast. A lot of times when they have the radiation, they have really bad dysphagia and brachytherapy or cryoablation, they'll have dysphagia. And so sometimes they will need short-term stents. And I emphasize short-term because the stents can migrate and that can actually perforate. I mean, there are a lot of complications that can be done due to the stent. So therefore it needs to be removed 6 to 8 weeks at the latest after the stent is placed. This is something that I don't know if you guys are doing this at your hospital, but it's the enhanced recovery after surgery. And I made the slide on the right side intentionally smaller because there's a lot of recommendations that they give. But the most important thing is a multidisciplinary approach, and it's involving not just surgery or medical doctors, but anesthesiologists, you have the nutrition dietitian, you have behavioral medicine, physical therapy, and we are doing this at my hospital, and our length of stay definitely has decreased, especially for after pancreatectomies, which I don't do, but we do a lot, and definitely helps with the patients in recovery. And this also involves some pain management as well. So the biggest things in the news these days, you know, hospital volume and where these esophagectomies or major procedures should be done. And everywhere you see high volume center, high volume center, high volume center. Everything should be done at high volume centers. And yeah, it makes sense. If you look at esophagectomies, for example, when they compared a low volume center versus high volume center, the mortality rate, it was 18.9% versus 8.1%. So looking at this number, and it's interesting because I've found several articles touting that this is a reason why these surgeries need to be done at high volume centers. But if you look at another study that recently published, the morbidity and mortality, instead of just looking at mortality, it's quite interesting because the mortality may be higher at low volume centers. The morbidity rate, there's no statistical significance. For example, for the pancreatic surgeries, for stroke or PE or heart attack, very low centers rate is 2.9%. Very high centers are 3.6%. And the length of stay, 17 to 36 days, 14 to 30 days. I mean, then you tell yourself, what is going on here? And this is a concept, I think, if you don't get anything out of the lecture, I think this is the most important concept to understand, not just for esophagectomies, but major procedures, is the concept of failure to rescue. And that makes sense because in high volume centers, we have medical students, interns, residents, fellows, super fellows. You have specialized nursing units. And all these people are used to looking at these patients and being able to realize that, hey, something is wrong, and they're able to act on it faster. Whereas in community hospitals, you may have nursing staff that may have seen one or two esophagectomies, and they might not realize, hey, this patient may be not doing as well, and they may not catch on. So these patients, 12, 24 hours after complications, a first sign of complications is shown, I mean, time is everything, and you're already behind. And so you may not be able to rescue these patients. And so it is something that's, I think, very important, even if it's at a low volume center, to be actively involved, not just rounding once a day, but having PAs and nurses who are dedicated on your patients. And I think that will decrease the mortality. And there was an article in Europe, and what they mentioned that was, they were able to make changes, and the mortality rate did go down, even at low volume center. At their low volume center. So, next is the comparisons of esophagectomies, and I really didn't want to deal with copyrighted material, so I drew all these things. But I'm not an artist, so kind of like elementary school. But transhiatal, bottom line, the yellow lines are the incisions. And a lot of the surgeons, even surgical oncologists, even thoracic surgeons, are doing transhiatals, which is quite surprising because I don't think it's as good of a surgery, especially obtaining lymph nodes. Then here's Ivor Lewis, which is an open abdomen and a thoracotomy. And then here's minimally invasive Ivor Lewis. And this is a case that I did a couple months ago, and I did a anastomosis. I know there's laser on this thing. All right, worked. So I did the anterior-side anastomosis, and I brought the esophagus down, kind of do a two-layer, and then I placed this fatty tissue, omentum fat, over as well. And so you could do that as well, minimally invasive, which is, when I was learning this, makes sense. However, with the advent of all these nerve blocks, including transversus abdominis plane block, tap block, and intercostal nerve block, even thoracotomies, if that needs to be done, actually, it's okay. The patients do they get discharged 3-4 days even after thoracotomy. So it's something that's already, for me, is changing. This is a picture of esophageal mobilization. Here's the hiatus. And then this is Firefly, which is looking at the perfusion during procedure. And it's indocyanine green, and injected, anesthesia injects it. And you could see how it's perfusing, and you could see the perfusion. And so for this patient, I made the incision here for the anastomosis because it took longer to provide for the blood supply to kind of fill. And I didn't want any anastomotic breakdown. And here's the esophagus before the anastomosis was created. So three field, and this is actually one of my favorite, and I think you get a really good lymphadenectomy. And if you find, and what I do is I start with, is do the thoracic portion first. I actually use the robot. And I do the lymphadenectomy and mobilize the esophagus. And I mobilize the esophagus all the way to the inlet, and so this is actually in the neck now. And so I could actually put, dissect all the way down so that, or up, and to the hiatus, so you have a freedom to move. But luckily, the esophagus has a longitudinal blood supply, so even if I do this, and if I find metastatic disease in the abdomen, I could still bail without having to do an esophagectomy. So this is a substernal esophagectomy, and which is a little more difficult when it comes to trying to get the gastric condor and the neoesophagus to come up. But this patient, I had to do an esophagostomy. And so here's a split fistula. You could see it coming up. And then after patient recovered, I actually placed the gastric conduit and an anastomosis in the neck. But that takes longer length, and even if you try to make this as posterior as possible within the neck, still you have a bulge and it's not as comfortable. The esophagus moves kind of in this direction, so you're not gonna have good swallowing capabilities. So comparisons, looking at transhiatal, Ivor Lewis, three field, there's no significant mortality when it comes to the three procedures. And the pneumonia rate is a little higher with the three field instead of transhiatal because you're not making a thoracotomy with these patients. The return to OR, same rate. So I think the most important thing about which approach you're gonna do is whatever approach you're comfortable with. And then comparison of minimally invasive versus traditional open. Lukatich, for example, MIE, thoracic, Ivor Lewis, and he says his leak is 11.7%. That's one of the things that you have to kind of consider what leak this is, and this is a clinically significant leak. So it was interesting because when I went to interview at Pittsburgh, all these patients were getting dilations, esophageal dilations after esophagectomies. Well, what that means is that they weren't getting clinically significant leaks, but they were getting leaks where it was causing stenosis. And so truthfully, the leak, I'm sure it's much higher than that, but what they publish is lower numbers. Like Dr. Orringer, you know, who's the father of esophagectomies. His leak rate, I believe, was about 9%, and he has done thousands, and I think that's about right. You know, and the problem with the McCown or transhiatal is the injury to the recurrent laryngeal nerve, but. And it was interesting, I was listening to a webinar recently how the general surgery residents these days are not getting used to the neck dissections But it's actually quite not that difficult as long as you keep doing it. So whatever procedures you're doing, whatever approach you're doing, you just need to do it consistently the same way. So comparing MIE, or minimally invasive neck anastomosis versus chest. So Ivor Lewis versus Threefield or McCown. Yes, I mean, it's, you know, because you're not going into the neck from the chest, you could get vocal cord paresis from the recurrent laryngeal nerve injury. But everything else is not clinically statistically significant, all the morbidities or mortality. So one of the important things I'm learning, and this is a continuous learning process, is radiated field. You know, how can we know that if with radiation, neoadjuvant radiation, you're gonna have increased risk of anastomotic leaks and complications, things are not gonna heal well. Well, I think the most important thing is trying to figure out where the radiation field was. So if you, like this is one of the patients I did, and the area in red is where they got the most amount of radiation. Well, for this patient, I did a McCown approach. Why? Because I didn't want to anastomose anything in this area. I wanted to utilize the esophagus that's higher, that's not been radiated. And I think that's the most important thing, on top of all the other things that I talked about earlier, including nutrition optimization, even physical therapy, and being able to walk, move, cough. And is there anything else? It's something that's really hard to deal with, but most important thing is knowing where the field is and how much radiation you got as well. Optimized nutrition, and then I talked about before, regional anesthetic blocks. And again, I'm a big minimally invasive. I did my fellowship in minimally invasive surgery. I'm a very big proponent of robotic surgery. And yet, when I see thoracotomies, or even open three fields, not having too much pain because of these intercostal blocks and tap blocks. Yes, smaller incision looks great, but if you're not comfortable doing MIE, I think you should still do open, but make sure to block these patients. Make sure you get good regional anesthetic so that they could actually embolate, decrease pneumonia, rate of pneumonias. One other thing that I learned hard, it's very difficult to kind of learn from, but is aggressive lymphadenectomy, especially around the carina, behind the trachea and the where the bronchia separate. If you do aggressive lymphadenectomy and thinking that you're not gonna do create an anastomosis there, if the radiation field is included in that area, you don't wanna do aggressive lymphadenectomy. Why? Because you could injure the membranous portion of the bronchus or the trachea, and then you could end up with dreaded tracheoesophageal fistula. And this is a patient that ended up having bronchopleural fistula and had a very prolonged course of hospitalization afterwards. And trying to fix this is very difficult. And now there is more literature on utilizing omental flaps instead of cutting off all the omentum, having a flap and bringing it up and to cover it, and having a vascularized tissue that would definitely help minimizing the anastomotic leak. But esophagectomies, even if everything does you do well, morbidity rate combined is about 40-50%, and it's very, esophagus is not a forgiving organ, and so it's, you have to be vigilant for the first 6 months. I mean, I consider first 6 months to make sure that this patient is doing okay until I could breathe easily. Otherwise, I'm always worrying about these patients, things going wrong, so.
So if anybody has any questions, we do have a microphone over here. Feel free to come up. I know people have lunch obligations as well as other meeting obligations, but I would be curious if there's any questions. Happy to handle them now. Yes, doctor.
Just one comment, I guess this isn't, oh, there it is. Just one comment about, I'm an endocrinologist, and thank you for the lecture, it's very excellent for
thank
Dr.
You.
Landesman.
Thank you, sir.
Another thing that can, I think, in diabetic diarrhea, or what can cause diarrhea in diabetics is a large amount of ingestion of artificial sweeteners, sugar substitutes. We see that all the time.
Yeah, very much so. No, I appreciate that because I think they're doing the right thing by trying to sort of look for alternatives to sugar. And I think especially, too, another thing that sort of flies under the radar is the sugarless chewing gums in patients that are diabetic or non-diabetic. But you're absolutely right. So it's hard to have those conversations with patients because they do want sort of a sweet satisfaction without having to pay the price. The trouble is they're not paying the price on the sugar side. They're paying the price on the symptom of the diarrhea side. Yeah, no, thank you very much. I appreciate it. Great comment.
Dr. Hoffman, thank you very much for an excellent lecture. Bile gastritis, bile reflux, is this a real entity? And could this explain some of our patients that don't respond to acid suppression?
Well,
this one's active.
Okay. I think that's the advantage of doing pH impedance. If bile gastritis itself is not the esophagus, right? So, but if patients are having reflux of non-acid, then a Bravo traditional pH testing won't show that. So pH impedance will tell us if they're refluxing bile. Then the question, of course, is what do you want to do with that? At least one consideration is anti-reflux surgery. You can consider baclofen, you can consider cholesterol-binding type agents, but I don't think that's very effective.
Thank you.
Yeah, this is for Dr. Hoffman. You know, a fair amount of my patients, I'm an endocrinologist and a taker of a lot of diabetics, and they also have a lot of, they're on PPIs for a long period of time. And I am finding that they are getting B12 and iron deficient on long-term therapy. And in fact, I've had several cases that have developed fulminant iron deficiency anemia without any source of bleeding at all in postmenopausal women that have been on PPIs for a number of years. I just wanted to address that. You were stating this talk that this was probably not a risk, but I'm kind of finding that long-term PPI is a risk for these malabsorptions of these very important vitamins and nutrients. I wish we could, can you comment on that?
Yeah, I said probably not risks, okay? It's hard to say 100% that they're not risks, except that the only evidence that they're truly risks is from observational studies that have so many confounding factors, and the number of patients that are prescribed PPIs, the few that have shown true deficiencies make me very skeptical that those are true risks. I think it goes back to the slide that says if you need it, give it. I don't think that the incidence of any of those micronutrients or B12 or B1 is sufficient enough to generate surveillance or testing for it, screening for it. I mean, obviously, if a patient develops a macrocytic anemia or symptoms of B1 deficiency, then we should check for it, but only if it's clinically significant. I mean, you understand what I'm trying to distinguish?
I'm just wondering
if you're...
I'm
not afraid of PPIs. I, as a gastroenterologist, what I see, unfortunately, is PPIs used when they're of no value. But if they're of value, I'm a real strong proponent of it.
So you're not recommending routine supplementation for patients that are supposedly on these drugs for more than a year or so of the B12 or the iron?
No routine supplements. The only supplement I take is vitamin D because I'm from Detroit.
I'd like to thank the panel.
One last mention, too, for that last question is I think H. pylori actually is another under-recognized cause of iron deficiency anemia. There have been some studies in the absence of ulceration, patients with H. pylori infection actually becoming iron deficient. So I think when you're doing an upper endoscopy to investigate that, even though the gastric mucosa may look relatively benign, and even the small bowel intestine may look relatively benign without classic findings of celiac. I oftentimes get accused for over-biopsying, but I have detected cases of H. pylori in relatively asymptomatic patients, and you do wonder long-term if that could be part of that pathophysiology that you mentioned, so I think that's a great point.
My question is for Dr. Smith. Have you noticed any increase in dumping syndrome and weight loss following alapnisin?
Yes, in the weight loss, simply because of a decrease in volume of the stomach by the gastric wrap, it'll accomplish sometimes around 20% of the volume. They can overdistend that over time, so it's not usually a long-term problem. And as far as the diarrhea, that seems to be a technical problem because of manipulation of the vagus nerves. The more trauma to the vagus themselves with the dissection, the higher the incidence of dumping or diarrhea afterwards. So it is certainly technically related, and it has to do with how much work you have to do at the hiatus itself.
Any correction for that after the nerves are injured?
Oh, man, I wish I did have. I could get wealthy with that. But no, those people are very, very difficult to deal with that have vagal injuries. And that's really interesting because in the early days of ulcer surgery, when we went in purposely to do vagotomies, we still had people that didn't develop hypo or decrease in the acid levels because we didn't get all of the trunks. So I find that kind of interesting that in some people, even though we've not transected the vagus nerve, we still get the effect of a post-vagotomy kind of dumping syndrome.
Thank you very much.
Yes, sir.
Richard Kimmel, Boca Raton, Florida. Another surgical question. You mentioned in these last set of slides about your preference for either the three-incisional approach or Ivor Lewis over the blunt esophagectomy. Considering the advancements over the last 20-plus years in CT scanning, PET scanning, transesophageal ultrasound, I would like you to comment, if you could, on how often you're surprised when you go into the operating room to find lymphadenopathy that you did not know about beforehand. Because it seemed to me what I heard, and maybe I misheard, was that you prefer those approaches because you get a better lymphadenectomy. And I guess my question is, how often are you surprised?
So, you know, lymphadenectomy, I think it's not to clear the disease, but to sample, and you're trying to decrease the sampling error. And so when I do aggressive lymphadenectomies, including lung surgery as well, but same thing with the esophagectomies, is how often do I get surprised? Probably about 20%, 20, 30%. The reason being is because they could have microscopic disease that you're not gonna see, you're never gonna be able to see. Even if you do esophageal ultrasound, EUS, and, you know, there's going to be, I mean, if there's microscopic disease on the node, trying to get at it with FNA, I mean, you're kind of shooting in a haystack and trying to find these cells. And so from my experience, about 20, 25%. It could be a little high, you know, maybe my experience is a little higher because we have a lot of patients who are coming in who or kind of second opinions. And so I don't see too many of the early stage cases, but that's one of the reasons why I do the lymphadenectomies. And that's transhiatals. I mean, you're just putting your hand in, and I mean, what kind of lymphadenectomy do you do? You really don't.
And a quick follow-up question. If in fact in those 20% you are surprised when you do get there, What other modalities do you use postoperatively? Do you follow them up with focal radiation or chemotherapy?
Usually the recommendation is chemotherapy and then restaging. And Dr. Smith, I have a question about the LINX procedure. I know it's It's been, 5 years since it came out? And how do you feel about the Lynx procedure for anti-reflux?
I personally don't do it. It certainly has potential, but as Dr. Marks and I were talking about it, it's hard not to remember back to the days of the Angelschek prosthesis and the erosions that occurred with them. At this point, it still looks encouraging, but it's certainly not first-line treatment at this point.
I'm seeing it with the gastric band, some erosions, and that really is a challenge to take care of.
Yeah, erosions with the bands are even more of a challenge, certainly.
Oh, definitely.
Yep.
One last question, actually, for Dr. Smith, too, because this comes up, which kind of goes back and forth between our specialties, is when you're doing your preoperative workup for patients for a potential anti-reflux surgery, and you're recommending pH studies or pH impedance, how do you determine who gets those tests on treatment, like on max dose PPI, or who do you decide to test off PPIs?
You know, there's really not an absolute. There are some patients that, you know, we try to treat or we try to do the testing off PPI, but there are quite clearly some of the people that cannot go
right
2 days without that. We try stepping them down, but even at that, the compliance certainly goes down. If somebody just simply cannot go without their PPI, I've probably already got the results before I do my
right
testing.
So. Right, right.